code SAVEDEMOCRACY24, which saves you 40-50% off the cost of a membership. I'll see you then. I'll be back with you tomorrow as well. We start today with the good little Supreme Court. They're really being a good little Supreme Court for Donald Trump, aren't they? The Supreme Court is serving Trump, announcing that they will take up his claim of presidential immunity, which bolsters and confirms Trump's delay strategy, as this will push one criminal trial out further. The New York Times reports, in taking up Trump's immunity claim, Supreme Court bolstered his delay strategy by scheduling a hearing for late April on the former president's assertion that he cannot be prosecuted for his actions in office. The justices increased the chance that he will not face trial by election day. This was Trump's strategy. And by gosh, those three Supreme Court justices that Trump nominated are going to help him out. The Supreme Court that former President Donald J. Trump helped to shape, writes Alan Foyer, tossed him a legal lifeline last night, making a choice that substantially aided his efforts to delay his federal trial on charges plotting to overturn the 2020 election. By deciding to take up Trump's claim that presidents enjoy almost total immunity from prosecution from any action while in office, the justices bought the former president at least several months before a trial on the election interference charges can start. This is what we feared, and it is happening. There's an article in Salon by Thomas Mukasher, which says with the January 6th case, the Supreme Court could take America down the dark road to dictatorship. And there are two elements to this. There's the timing element, which by taking up a hearing on this issue in late April, they functionally and practically delay this trial from starting. If the finding is Trump's immune for everything he did while he was president, it also further generates a precedent which could be used to enshrine dictatorial authoritarian presidencies in the United States. Now, there is another practical idea that is being floated, which makes a lot of sense to me about this, which is the Supreme Court has justices there now, Thomas Alito, who could be interested in retiring in the next few years. They would like to retire with a Republican president in office rather than a Democrat so that their replacements will maintain a right-wing court. As such, they are acting in a way to help Trump get elected. The idea being they are going to delay the criminal trial because they have seen the polling that a conviction hurts Trump in the election. By delaying the trial, maybe they help Trump get elected, which ultimately leads to their being able to retire, knowing that their replacements will be on the right. Here is Judge Luttig on MSNBC saying this is a big deal. The Supreme Court doesn't have to hear this. They're choosing to do this.
The state Supreme Court will hear Trump's immunity case.
Well, thank you for having me with you this afternoon, Nicole. I'm just hearing this moment.
I just heard it in my ears through the...
Look, this is a momentous decision just to hear this case. There was no reason in this world for the Supreme Court to take this case. The three-judge panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia had written a masterful opinion denying that the president's claims of absolute immunity. Under the Constitution and the laws of the United States, there's never been an argument that a former president is immune from prosecution for crimes that he committed while in office. On the more practical level, of course, Supreme Court is capable of deciding this very quickly in time that the former president could be tried before the election.
Right.
But today's decision makes that much more unlikely.
Just explain that fork in the road. If they had refused to hear it, the appeals court ruling would have held, and the trial, Judge Tanya Chutkan could have scheduled her trial.
Correct.
Yes. And that's...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The armed gangs forced us to leave our homes. They destroyed our houses, and we're on the streets.
Haiti's under a state of emergency. Thousands of Haitians are fleeing rising gang violence. We'll go to the capital, Port-au-Prince, for an update, and to Nairobi to speak with a Kenyan lawmaker who opposes sending 1,000 Kenyan police to Haiti as part of a UN peacekeeping force. Then federal prosecutors in New York rest their case against former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, accused of turning the Central American country into a narco state. We'll get the latest. And we speak with the producer of the Oscar-nominated Holocaust film Zone of Interest, who raised Israel's assault on Gaza in his BAFTA award acceptance speech last month.
Those walls aren't new from before or during or since the Holocaust, and it seems stark right now that we should care about innocent people being killed in Gaza or Yemen in the same way we think about innocent people being killed in Mariupol or in Israel.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled Monday states do not have the authority to remove Donald Trump from the ballot under the Insurrection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which was written to prevent Civil War Confederates from returning to government. The court's ruling came after the state of Colorado attempted to take Trump off the primary ballot over his actions inciting the January 6th insurrection. In the majority opinion, justices wrote, quote, states have no power under the Constitution to enforce Section 3 with respect to federal offices, especially the presidency. The court's three liberal justices issued a concurring opinion warning the majority ruling, quote, attempts to insulate all alleged insurrectionists from future challenges to their holding federal office. Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold responded to the court's ruling on MSNBC.
My larger reaction is disappointment. I do believe that states should be able, under our Constitution, to bar oath-breaking insurrectionists.
Millions of voters are heading to the polls today as 15 states are holding primaries and caucuses in what's known as Super Tuesday. In California, there's a four-way race to fill the seat of the late Senator Dianne Feinstein. Three Democratic Congress members, Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, and Barbara Lee, are on the ballot, along with Republican Steve Garvey, a former Major League Baseball player. The top two candidates, regardless of party, will face off in November. In Minnesota, some Democratic activists are urging voters to select uncommitted on the ballot to protest Joe Biden's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Jelani Hussein is co-chair of the Abandon Biden campaign.
For Tuesday, it's not Minnesotan Muslims. It's not the Muslims in the United States. It's really the overwhelming majority of Democrats who believe that the president is on a very dark course. So many children have been killed in Gaza, over 30,000 dead. Every single day, the Israeli Defense Force is killing innocent people. And our president has stayed silent, has not done anything. In fact, we have done the opposite. We have stopped the world from calling and stopping this war and calling for an immediate ceasefire.
The World Health Organization is warning malnutrition in northern Gaza is, quote, particularly extreme as talks continue over a possible six-week temporary ceasefire. On Monday, Palestinian UN ambassador Riyad Mansour warned children in Gaza are increasingly dying of starvation. He raised the case of Yazan al-Kafarna, an emaciated 10-year-old Palestinian child who died of severe malnutrition and insufficient health care.
Look at our children. Look at Yazan. Look what agony they are enduring. Dozen more children who died of malnutrition have been identified, and many more have died and are dying in darkness and destitution. This has to stop. For God's sakes, this has to stop.
A team of United Nations experts say they found, quote, reasonable grounds to believe that sexual violence, including rape, occurred on October 7th during the Hamas attack on Israel. The UN Special Envoy for Sexual Violence, Pramila Patton, spoke at the United Nations Monday.
We also found that there are reasonable grounds to believe that conflict-related sexual violence, including rape and gang rape, occurred during the 7th of October attacks in at least three locations, namely the Nova Music Festival site and its surroundings, Road 232 and Kibbutz Reim. And in most of these incidents, victims were first subjected to rape and then killed, and at least two incidents relate to the rape of women's corpses.
The UN expert, Pramila Patton, went on to say reports of rapes occurring at a fourth location, Kibbutz Be'eri, were unfounded. She said her team had also found, quote, clear and convincing information that some hostages held in Gaza had also suffered sexual violence. The UN experts did not conduct their own investigation, but instead wrote the report based in large part from conversations with Israeli institutions, including Zaha, an Israeli search and rescue organization that's been accused of spreading false stories about atrocities on October 7th. The UN team said it did not meet with any survivors of the sexual violence from October 7th. Patton also said her team received reports about imprisoned Palestinians facing sexual violence while in Israeli detention.
We nevertheless received, whilst there, from several interlocutors, information about cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment of Palestinians, men and women, in detention, also under the administrative detention, including sexual violence in the forms of invasive body searches, threats of rape and prolonged forced nudity.
2 weeks ago, a group of UN experts expressed alarm over the abuse of Palestinian women and girls held by Israel. In a statement, the experts said, quote, we are particularly distressed by reports that Palestinian women and girls in detention have also been subjected to multiple forms of sexual assault, such as being stripped naked and searched by male Israeli army officers. At least two female Palestinian detainees were reportedly raped, while others were reportedly threatened with rape and sexual violence, unquote. The UN experts said that Israeli troops took photos of female Palestinian detainees in degrading circumstances and posted them online. Ukraine is claiming it sunk a Russian warship in the Black Sea. Ukrainian naval drones reportedly attacked the $65 million ship off the coast of Crimea. In other news from the region, more than 20,000 soldiers from NATO countries have begun a massive war exercise in the northern regions of Finland, Norway and Sweden. 4,000 troops are taking part from Finland, which joined NATO last year and shares a 800-mile border with Russia. The head of the military junta in Chad's confirmed he'll run in the upcoming election for president. Mohamed Idriss Deby Itno made the announcement Saturday, just days after his chief rival was killed. Yahya Dillo died when security forces opened fire on the headquarters of his political party, the Socialist Party Without Borders. South Korea's government has announced it's moving to suspend the licenses of thousands of doctors who've been on strike for at least 2 weeks. About 7,000 doctors have defied orders by South Korean officials to return to work by the end of February. Doctors have been protesting the government's plan to increase medical school admissions by around 65%. They're demanding higher wages and a more manageable workload. Jack Teixeira, a member of the Massachusetts Air National Guard, has pleaded guilty to posting secret intelligence reports about the war in Ukraine and other issues online. He could serve 16 years in prison. He was indicted last year under the Espionage Act and has been jailed since April 2023 after he posted a series of highly classified Pentagon intelligence documents to a group of gamers on the messaging app Discord. And in Connecticut, five anti-nuclear activists connected to the Catholic worker movement were arrested Monday for blocking the gates of a General Dynamics plant in New London, where the Columbia-class nuclear submarines are being designed and constructed. During the action, a group of 20 protesters held life-sized images of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, with a banner reading, "Don't be a destroyer of worlds. Stop the Columbia sub." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Haiti, where Port-au-Prince's international airport is reportedly under siege by armed gangs as Haiti is under a state of emergency. Tens of thousands have been displaced across the Haitian capital as they flee rising violence.
The armed gangs forced us to leave our homes. They destroyed our houses, and we're on the streets.
Over the weekend, Haiti's powerful gangs freed thousands from Haiti's largest prisons. The gang federation, known as known as Barbecue, claim responsibility and is calling for the ousting of unelected Prime Minister Ariel Henry. Gang members are reportedly uniting to bring down Haiti's de facto Prime Minister Henry, who's yet to return to Haiti since he traveled to Kenya last week to discuss a deal to send about 1,000 Kenyan police to lead a UN peacekeeping force. The Kenyan High Court in January ruled the plan unconstitutional. For more, we're joined by three guests. In Nairobi, Otiende Omolo is a Kenyan parliamentarian who opposes the police deployment to Haiti. In Washington, D.C., Jake Johnston is with us. He runs Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch blog for the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of the new book, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti. But first, we go to Port-au-Prince, Haiti's capital, to speak with Monique Kleska, a Haitian pro-democracy advocate who worked for many years with UNICEF and the United Nations overall, worked there for 15 years. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Monique Kleska. Can you talk about what's happening on the ground as the images we see are the airport overrun and in the streets of Port-au-Prince, people fleeing for their lives?
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you. It is a desolation that we are feeling. It is a terror that we are living, and it's horrifying what we are going through. Since last Thursday, there has been an assault on different neighborhoods, different areas, and state institutions. And yesterday was the big assault then on the airport. So people cannot travel, people are scared, people cannot go to work. And on Saturday night, it was the jail. There was a massive assault on the Port-au-Prince jail, and there are about 4,000 prisoners who are out in the streets somewhere, and among them, presumed rapists, murderers, kidnappers, etc. So we are terrorized. We are terrorized in our homes. But what I want to say is that, and it's important to say that, we have been terrorized for the last 30 months of Ariel Henry's government. There have been more massacres under Ariel Henry than there were under Jovenel Moïse, that had 13 massacres. So we have been in a state of terror, horror. Our people are dying. Our sisters are being raped. Our children are going to sleep hungry for the last 30 months or more. So we are under a regime of bandits, bandits in ties, bandits in shorts. But bottom line, we are hostages of about maybe 3,000 men who are running the country either either in gangs with ties or in white shirts, or in gangs in the slum areas, roaming the streets and terrifying us. That is the situation we are living right now in Haiti. And let's be clear, the Biden administration has its hands in the bloodshed, because we, at least in, from the Montana Accord, have been saying since August 2021, 2.5 years ago, that this must stop. We have an alternative solution. We must get those criminals out of offices. We must get those criminals out. So the Biden administration is paying the price, because there is no doubt in my mind that they bear a huge responsibility, along with the UN, along with France, along with Canada. But the Biden administration has its knee on our necks, because we would not be here if they had listened to us Haitians, who have said for a long time, this is unacceptable. This criminal regime is unacceptable to us Haitians. Throughout Haiti, Haitians have demonstrated and said Ariel Henry must go. So he can stay in Kenya, he can stay in Washington, wherever he is, he can stay there. But we need new blood in the governance system of Haiti. We need visionaries, men and women who can provide for Haitians.
Monique Glasscott, you focused. You said on the criminals in white suits or in white shirts, but the focus in this in most of the media coverage about Haiti here in the United States is on the gangs in the street. Are all these gangs the same, or are there distinctions between them? Because some people claim that some are more political than some of the other gangs, especially, for instance, this Jimmy Cherizé and his group. How do you regard this situation on the street with these gangs?
I am here to say that the government, coming from, there are UN reports that have said that the former president of Haiti actually formed the gang and armed gangs. So since 2011, it has been a criminal regime that has armed the gangs. And now perhaps the gangs have felt stronger and they are going about in their, whatever it is, their criminal business. But the point I am making is the government, people in power, president, prime ministers, ministers. There is even a document from the Yale Law School Clinic and Human Rights Organization in Haiti that said it's a crime against humanity under Jovenel Moïse, the massacre in La Saline, where 71 people were killed. So we are talking about a construct. This is not something that happened out of the blue. These government officers, as well as prime minister, president, and some economic oligarchs, have financed the gangs, they have armed the gangs, they have given them even contracts to distribute food in neighborhoods, etc. So we must be clear that the gangs have been instrumentalized in the past, created, armed to terrorize us so that they could keep power. So now the gangs have gained their independence and maybe they have their political whatever. But I think the main culprit here is government that started to finance them, senators. A lot of them are under sanction for arming the gangs or for giving them money. A lot of the huge economic players in Haiti are also under sanction. Even a bank director is under sanction, even though it is not the United Nations sanctions. So let's be clear about this. There is no doubt in my mind about this, that the gangs with white shirts or whatever shirts and ties are also extremely involved, not only involved, but responsible for this. And the United States knows this. We have told this to Assistant Secretary Brian Nichols. We have told this to Barbara Feinstein at the State Department. We have told this to Dan Erickson, who is now at the White House. We have told this. The Biden administration knows this, that it is a criminal regime, that it is financing, that it is supporting, that it is helping to kill us. And we say it's enough. We need new leadership in Haiti. We need different governance that respects our human rights. This is unattainable. This is unbelievable. It is inadmissible. We do not want this, and we are into resistance mode. We are saying no. We do not want this, and the Biden administration will pay for some of this, because there are 1.5 million Haitian in the United States, and they are beginning to threaten not to vote for Biden. So vote elections are decided by a few thousand votes. So 1.5 million Haitians, that means a lot. They must reverse course. They must.
I'd like to bring in Jake Johnston, also the author of the new book, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti. Welcome, Jake Johnston. Your assessment of the situation right now in Haiti and the steps that need to be taken to restore some sense of safety to the population and an actual functioning government?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I mean, I think when we look at Haiti, we have to understand some of the roots of what we're seeing today. And at the heart of this is a broken social contract, a state that is no longer representative of or accountable to the population. And that has created the dynamics, the broader situation that has allowed this situation to spiral the way it has. And so when you look at how to address that, you have to start there. And I'd echo Munich's calls to focus on the political environment, right? We can't divorce insecurity from the political environment. And you look at what's happening now. I mean, this doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? The armed groups don't seize control, don't take this without at least some willingness or abandonment on a part of police hierarchy and government authorities. And so to begin with, there has to be an acceptance of responsibility. I think one of the most shocking things over the last 4 or 5 days has been the absolute total silence from the government, right? Ariel Henry is not even in the country. The state of emergency was announced by the Minister of Finance in a press release. And so there's really just, again, a total abandonment on the part of state authorities. And like Monique said, you know, this is not a crisis entirely created in Haiti or by Haitians, right? We have to understand that this has been a long time coming, and it's been a process stoked and perpetuated by the international community, and namely the United States. You know, we could go back to Haiti's history, to its founding, first independent black republic, successful slave revolt, the U.S. occupation, but we don't need to go back that far into history to see this history of intervention. The 2004 coup d'etat, the overturning of election results in 2010, and the United States' insistence on moving forward with this current government against all odds and against the very clear expression from the Haitian people. And so unless that begins to change, you know, it's extremely unlikely that the situation on the ground meaningfully improves.
Jake, I wanted to ask you about the role of a former president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, obviously removed from office twice, but at the same time, there are reports that he has had some kind of an accommodation with Ariel Henry, and that his family, Lavalas, is basically on the sidelines these days. Could you, what information do you have about that?
You know, I think you have to, you know, it's a murky political environment right now. There have been political negotiations and horse trading happening for 2 years. And I think, you know, that breakdown, the inability of Ariel Henry to actually come together and reach an accord and meaningfully balance power with alternatives, right? Like, there's not a single elected official in the country. Power has been consolidated under one unelected person who's had questions over his legitimacy from the moment he stepped foot in the premature, right, in the prime minister's office. And so, of course, many political parties are trying to push, trying to prod. I think Femi Lavalas has certainly been one of them. But where this actually ends up, I mean, I think everyone is clear. And I think in a lot of ways what we're seeing right now is a fight between protecting the status quo, trying to put the train back on the track, so to speak, or actually building something new, right, refounding the state and rebuilding that social contract that has been broken.
I wanted to go to Jimmy Charizier, known as Barbecue, speaking Friday.
We ask the Haitian National Police and the military to take responsibility and arrest Ariel Henry. Once again, the population is not our enemy. The armed groups are not your enemy. You arrest Ariel Henry for the country's liberation. These weapons that we have are not here to hurt our brothers who come from the same milieu as us. The poor take the streets and they trust us. These weapons are our symbol of freedom. With these weapons, we will liberate the country, and these weapons will change the country.
Monique Leska, Barbecue, or Charizier, is the leader of the gang federation G9 Family and Allies. They've joined together all the gangs. This is significant. And he's saying that they won't let Henri back into the country. Can you talk about the significance of this alliance and who he is?
Well, I don't want to talk about who he is, because I think he said who he is and he showed who he is. And he has been showing who he is for years now. What I want to say, though, is that I don't believe in violence. And the Montana movement that I'm part of does not believe in violence, and we condone violence. Guns cannot be symbols of a freedom. Guns cannot be that. So another question is, where are they getting all of these ammunitions? Where are they getting all these guns? M14, M1, Kalashnikov, et cetera. Where are they getting them? So I think it is important to say that the guns are coming from mostly from Miami, from the United States. Some are coming from the Dominican Republic, through the Dominican Republic, but there. So I think that is the central issue there, you know, in terms of the where are the armed groups, because they say they are armed groups and they claim that and they have their project. But where is it coming from? And what I'm saying is we have been living under, we have been kidnapped, we have been killed, our sisters are raped. So let's be very clear about this. The gangs, I cannot say much more about the gangs other than what their actions have shown. What I know, though, is that in Haiti, they have been supported by the governors of Haiti, the leaders like Ariel Henry. And the social justice agenda that we have, people are not eating, people don't have health care, people are not going to school, is extremely important. And that's what must be put forward. The issue of youth in Haiti, 65% of the Haitian population is under 24 years old. So when you hold a gun next to them, as opposed to feeding them, then very often they might go the other way towards the gun. And what we need to do is have a leadership, men and women, who can say that we will respect that social contract that Jake Johnson is talking about to remove this massive inequality, respect the human rights of Haitians, and feed Haitians, give them health care, particularly the youth. Two-thirds of the country is under 24 years old. We need to focus on them rather than focus on the gangs and everything else. And that's why we need to break what is right now a government that is killing us, literally and figuratively, with the help of the UN and the United States, the Biden administration. That is the focus for me.
I wanted to bring in Otiende Omolo, who is a Kenyan MP, member of parliament. Ariel Henry was last seen in Kenya, sealing the deal of sending 1,000 Kenyan police as part of a UN force, peacekeeping force, to Haiti. And yet, the Kenyan High Court in January ruled the plan was unconstitutional. You had a group of Kenyans go to Haiti to investigate the situation. They came back almost immediately, within hours, then went to Washington to work out the deal. And one of those Kenyans, 39-year-old Nyamato Walter, was found dead in his Washington, D.C. hotel room. Otiende Omolo, can you talk about the plan and are 1,000 Kenyan police being sent to Haiti?
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. The sense in Kenya is that the idea of sending 1,000 police officers to Haiti is unpopular. That is the general sense. But I would say the move is wrong in at least four fronts. First, it is legally unfounded. Secondly, the process itself is flawed. Thirdly, the rationale is quite shaky. And more importantly, the arrangements that seem to have been put in place are weak. In the first place, yes, the court in Kenya declared the process unconstitutional and improper. And that declaration was based on two things. First, it's based on the idea that we have not had a bilateral treaty with Haiti, and we have not had any reciprocation arrangement by way of an agreement. It is that agreement that was now sought to be had last week, which has still not been perfected. But it still leaves a lot of issues that are pending. The biggest issue is that under our constitution and our laws, our police force cannot be deployed abroad. Our police force is national. They can only operate within the Kenyan borders. On the contrary, it is the armed forces that can be deployed. For some strange reason, they have chosen to deploy the police, which still remains against the constitution. We have a constitution that clearly distinguishes between the police service and the defense forces. Only the forces can be deployed with the approval of the National Assembly. As we speak, and for reasons that I think Monique has already captured, we do not have any bilateral treaty arrangement between Kenya and Haiti. I think primarily also because there's no legitimate legislature or executive that can enter into that arrangement. And so the idea of the reciprocation agreement that was apparently entered last week or was being negotiated is still one that is not well-founded in the Constitution. But beyond that, we have questioned the process. The process is flawed from the one go. There was no request to this country to send any forces or any police officers. Instead, it is clear that our government offered, and immediately the offer was made. The President of the United States welcomed that move, and it is only thereafter that there was a move to bring the issue to the UN Security Council, by way of ratification. As I understand it, there was a general resolution which invited support. It was not specific to Kenya. It invited those who can support to show support. It came at a time that there were active court orders which have still not been set aside. So the entire move is one that flies in the face of the rule of law. Thirdly, we keep saying that we have thousands of armed forces, personnel who are in the barracks, and we have police officers who are not even enough to man this country. As you may have seen in the papers, there are pockets of insurrections in this country and deaths. They're in a place called Baringo. People were killed 3 days ago in a place called Samburu, even as late as yesterday. And so our argument is you cannot deploy the police abroad when you need the police in Kenya. In terms of priority, and I think Monique said some things that are very profound in terms of history, we think that in terms of assistance, there are countries that carry the higher burden of intervention than Kenya, countries that have had historical involvement with Haiti, countries that have much more superior you know, defense forces that could intervene, countries that have been seen to intervene elsewhere, and why they would then backpass and ask Kenya to send 1,000, police officers is what we are questioning. It just amounts to backpassing. From what Monique described and what we've seen, in the media, 1,000 police officers, even if there were 5,000, yeah, cannot bring any sanity to the situation. So we are very worried that the 1,000 police officers sent to Haiti, we are not sure where they are right now anyway, but we
Mr. Amoyo, if I can, I just wanted to get in Jake Johnston because we're almost running out of time. And Jake, I wanted to have your last comments. This whole issue of whether a peaceful change in Haiti can occur or whether the failure of the government, the threat of new international intervention and the desperate situation of the Haitian people really does call for some kind of a armed revolt by the people of Haiti. Your sense of that?
Well, look, I mean, I think, you know, in regard to the Kenya mission, right, I mean, we have to understand that there was United Nations peacekeepers following the 2004 coup d'etat that were in the country for 13 years at a cost of over $7 billion. And so we're now talking about doing this, but the situation on the ground is a reminder of the failure of those efforts, right? We're talking about a situation now in Haiti where police can't even get paid, and we're shocked that they're not putting up more resistance. So I think, you know, the solutions are local. They can be local, right? International actors have a role to play in supporting actual local solutions rather than undermining local institutions and local organizations, which has been a pattern repeated ad nauseum over Haiti's history, right? So I think there can be a peaceful resolution, but it's going to take change in policies both in Haiti and especially in the United States as well.
Jake Johnston, we want to thank you for being with us. Runs the Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch blog for Center for Economic and Policy Research. His new book, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti. We want to thank Monique Kleska, Haitian pro-democracy advocate, speaking to us from Port-au-Prince, and Otiende Omolo, Kenyan member of parliament, speaking to us from Nairobi. Next up, federal prosecutors rest their case against the former Honduran president accused of turning Honduras into a narco state. We'll get the latest in 20 seconds. Organization Mondiale yo pa pou nou yo ye. Sa la pou e devole yo piye devore. Le pep ki lundi pran fizi yo konen yo bouke. La médecine internationale, ça met colle sous côté. Yo fait réunion, yo parle, yo rancé. Devant vers champagne, bon divin, qu'importe, c'est la s'arrêter. World Organizations by Mano Charlemagne. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Here in New York, prosecutors have rested their case against the former Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who's on trial for cocaine trafficking and weapons charges as prosecutors accuse Hernandez of ruling the Central American country as a narco state. He's the first former head of state to stand trial in the U.S. since the Panamanian dictator and U.S. ally Manuel Noriega, who was ousted in 1989 when U.S. forces invaded Panama, and later he was convicted on drug charges. Hernandez is accused of accepting millions of dollars in bribes from cocaine traffickers in exchange for protection. During the trial, several convicted drug traffickers testified against him, including some affiliated with the Sinaloa cartel and the son of another former U.S.-backed Honduran president, Porfirio Pepe Lobo Sosa. Hernandez was arrested in February 2022, less than a month after his presidential term ended, and extradited to the U.S. in April of 2022. He was a longtime U.S. ally who received backing during his entire eight-year term, despite mounting reports of human rights violations and accusations of corruption involvement with drug smuggling. His brother, Tony Hernandez, Juan Antonio Hernandez, is now serving a prison sentence in the U.S., a life sentence after being convicted in 2019 of smuggling cocaine. Juan Orlando Hernandez faces life in prison if convicted as well. For more, we're joined by two guests who've been attending the trial in New York. Dana Frank is professor of history emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror in the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. And Oscar Estrada, a Honduran writer and screenwriter. His latest book, Land of Narcos, How the Mafias Took Over Honduras. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Frank, why don't you start by giving us the overall context before we get into what's testified at this trial?
The main thing here is that the U.S. is apparently deciding to try one of its most important allies. And the overall context of this is, of course, the U.S. support for the 2009 military coup, which the U.S. backed and allowed to stabilize. And that, in turn, destroyed the rule of law in Honduras. So it's not just that Juan Orlando is randomly a corrupt drug trafficker and repressive figure, but the U.S. supported him. They supported the previous president, Porfirio Pepe Lobo, and allowed the destruction of the rule of law, which then opened the door for the kind of criminal behavior and drug trafficking, not only by the narcos, but by figures at the top of the military, the government, and the police.
I'd like to ask Oscar Estrada. You've also been at the trial. What struck you most about it so far? Especially, could you talk about the testimony of Fabio Lobo, son of the former president, Porfirio Lobo?
Yeah, I think at this point it's been shown very clear the involvement of narco money, narcotraffic money into Honduran elections. And it's very interesting that United States prosecutors now is trying to back up for the original indictment about election fraud in the 2013 election, which is the one that's been shown the most. And I think that all the different witnesses are saying that they pay bribe for the different candidates in the United States. And I think the Honduran people have been expecting more about this trial in the sense that we're trying to see what happened in the elections, what happened with all this different narco-traffic involvement on political campaign. And with Fabio Lobo, I think that it's very clear delivering in the witness day that he has a lot more to say that it wasn't really shown there. And at the end, it shows like a man full of resentment of his father and a different political figure that left him alone when he was arrested in Haiti in 2015.
And Dana Frank, why did the United States turn so dramatically against a leader that it supported for two terms in office, one of which was ostensibly an illegal term?
Well, I think the first term, I mean, you see the amount of money that flowed in from narcos for his first term has come out in the trial. So I think that underscores how corrupt both elections were, which I've been saying all along, as have many Hondurans. I think the question is to answer how the U.S. turned on Juan Orlando is like you have to disaggregate who the United States is in here, because it's been the Southern District of New York that's been independently following these cases, building the case that have led to Juan Orlando Hernandez, and before that, his brother Tony. And the evidence that I know is that the U.S., the White House and the State Department have not been happy about this. I mean, I've interviewed officials at the State Department and three different ambassadors, and it was clear they were very hostile to the Southern District and all these cases that they've been gaining. And it's also clear that although Obama and Trump and Biden all supported Juan Orlando Hernandez, Biden did not want the Southern District of New York to charge and extradite Juan Orlando Hernandez until after Hernandez was out of office. And so it's like very important, because otherwise it looks like the U.S., you know, there's a narrative here that you could see in the New York Times, for example, that suddenly the Honduran people can't govern themselves. And then suddenly the U.S. is coming in and heroically imposing the rule of law. And it's the opposite. It's the United States that helped destroy the criminal justice system in Honduras, and Obama and Trump did not want Juan Orlando to be charged and extradited.
So, Oscar Estrada, if you can talk about the human rights situation on the ground when Joe, J-O-H, Juan Orlando Hernandez, was president. For example, turning the Honduran military essentially into private security guards for drug traffickers, and what that meant for human rights activists and people on the ground who are critical of the president.
Well, it's clear that we have seen since the coup d'etat in 2009 a deterioration of the human rights situation in Honduras. And from then on, you know, like pretty much all the the last decade has been a lot of accusation of violation of human rights. And the military role is very important. And we see it now with his defense. What we see in generals of the army actually came here and taking the stand supporting his defense. It's very clear that he was backed up by the military from the beginning, and the military is now defending him. So it's clear that the army in Honduras, even though they're trying to back it up from this military officers, generals, most of them, they are like in the stand for the defense witness. They're trying to back it up, but it's clear that it still have a lot of influence inside the army.
And Dana, Frank, I wanted to ask you, it's been 2 years since Xiomara Castro was elected president at the head of a popular movement in Honduras. Has U.S. policy toward Honduras changed at all, or is it still backing the corrupt elite of the former president?
Well, there's a very clear pattern since very early on when Xiomara first took office of the U.S. supporting the very same actors it has for many years, working with the National Party, that's Juan Orlando Hernandez's party, working with corrupt figures at the top of the National Party. The actual head of the party is a fugitive from justice as we speak, and trying to pressure Libre, the ruling party, to accept National Party as an equal actor. And the U.S. Ambassador Lara Dogo has very aggressively been trying to undermine human Honduran sovereignty, opposing tax reform law, opposing the reform electrical system, very aggressively supporting the ZEDES, which are these so-called model cities that are total violation of the Honduran Constitution. It's very clear that the U.S. agenda is to support transnational corporate investments in Honduras, which it always has. And, of course, it cares about Honduras as part of its larger geopolitical effort to militarily dominate the hemisphere.
And finally, Oscar, the former head of Honduras's national police pleaded guilty Tuesday to cocaine trafficking. Juan Carlos Bonilla, known as El Tigre, appeared in a New York City court just days before he was scheduled to go on trial with the president, with Juan Orlando Hernandez. Can you talk about the significance of his guilty plea as we wrap up?
Well, I think that we in Honduras, we would want it. Tigre Bonilla to be persecuted for all his human rights violation record, which is very well known and recorded in Honduras. Instead of that, he's playing guilty for one charge of narco traffic. What we don't want is for that to be a cover-up of this record of human rights violation from the coup d'etat, and way before, he was one of the leaders of the one death squads in the early 2000s, and very famous. And he built a career as a repressor. And now that he's been sentenced, I mean, he's going to be sentenced in the South District Court in the United States, we want to know more about what else have he done during this time in the being chief of police.
And Professor Frank, we just have 30 seconds, but as the U.S. increasingly criminalizes immigrants coming into this country, the huge flow of, for example, Honduran immigrants, the connection between migration and what the U.S. has supported in Honduras?
Well, people are fleeing because they're fleeing the gangs, they're fleeing poverty, and they're fleeing the post-coup regime, three different presidents that have destroyed the country and have been backed by the United States in doing that. The United States is the single biggest factor creating the crisis in Honduras, the single biggest factor why people are fleeing. And then it turns around and says somehow they're a disaster down there independently, when actually it's the U.S. that's responsible for why people are fleeing Honduras.
Dana Frank, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of History Emerita at University of California, Santa Cruz, and Oscar Estrada, Honduran writer and screenwriter. His latest book, Land of Narcos, How the Mafias Took Over Honduras. Coming up, we speak with the producer of the Oscar-nominated Holocaust film, Zone of Interest, who raised Israel's assault on Gaza in his BAFTA Acceptance Award. Stay with us. Johann Strauss's Tales from the Vienna Woods, performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with the producer of the Oscar-nominated Holocaust film, Zone of Interest, about the family of Nazi Commandant Rudolf Höss living in a tranquil life on the opposite side of the wall of the Auschwitz concentration camp. First, this is the film's trailer.
These flowers are so beautiful.
The azaleas there. There are also vegetables. A few herbs, rosemary, beetroot. This is fennel, sunflowers. And here's kohlrabi. The children love to eat it.
The heartfelt time we spent in the Höss house will always be among our most beautiful holiday memories. In the east lies our tomorrow. Thanks for your National Socialist hospitality.
The Zone of Interest just won 3 BAFTA awards last month for Best Sound, Best British Film, and Best Film Not in the English Language. During his acceptance speech, producer James Wilson raised Israel's assault on Gaza.
A friend wrote me after seeing the film the other day that he couldn't stop thinking about the walls we construct in our lives, which we choose not to look behind. Those walls aren't new from before or during or since the Holocaust, and it seems stark right now that we should care about innocent people being killed in Gaza or Yemen in the same way we think about innocent people being killed in Mariupol or in Israel.
For more, we're joined by James Wilson, producer of the Oscar-nominated film The Zone of Interest. Nominated for Best Picture, among others, the Oscar ceremony is Sunday, Best International Picture. Congratulations, James Wilson, on all the nominations and what you won at the BAFTAs. Talk about that experience and why you related what's happening now with Israel's assault on Gaza to this Holocaust film, and talk specifically about that wall that separated the commandant's home from the Auschwitz concentration camp.
Well, thank you, Amy. Good morning. Thank you for inviting me on the show. Why I said that? I mean, as you heard in the clip, I related the film both to the in the present moment to the Israeli assault on Gaza, but also the innocent victims in Israel on October the 7th. And I mentioned Yemen, and I mentioned Ukraine too, Mariupol too. So the context of that, which felt it felt organic to the idea of the film, the questions of the film. You know, I know politics in film award speeches can grate sometimes, but this, as I said, this felt very pertinent to what the film's about, which is as you say, the walls that separate us from things that we choose not to look at, just as the friend who'd messaged me about the film saying he couldn't stop thinking about that in his own daily life. And all of that just came together. I was obviously thinking about it beforehand. I felt it was a nervous moment just to speak in front of a lot of people. I've never won an award for a film I've worked on, but it felt organic to the idea of the film. And you mentioned the wall in the film. It's the film stages an absolutely real situation, which is the family of the commandant of Auschwitz and his wife and the family and the life they led in a nice house and garden that exactly abutted Auschwitz in full operation in the early 1940s and that wall, which is in the film and in that situation, is absolutely real. Is of course also a metaphor for, as my friend's message said, the way we can sort of occlude and tune out systematic violence, injustice, oppression, all sorts of things from our lives in order that we go on with them. I suppose the film asks that question. What are the walls in our lives like? Do we have walls like that in our life? Are there groups of people whom we care about more than others as groups of people socially, not as friends and family? And it seems quite clear that that is the case. And I suppose the other thing about the film is we always wanted it to be feel modern and feel about the present, everything about how we made it, how John Glazer, the writer director of the film, wanted to make it, was to make it feel like it was happening in the present and it reflected the present. And that was through the tools of filmmaking, cinematography, acting, music, sound design, to create this immersive feeling of present tenseness, which was a means to an hopeful end, which was to reflect us in the present. And John's also spoken about how it's a political film. And one of the things that's happening in the present is this extraordinary, staggering loss of innocent life in killing of innocent people in Gaza and in the occupied territories that is a response to the heinous mass killing of October the 7th. But it just seems very stark in the world that we have politically, our governments at least, have a different level of care and attitude to those innocent people being killed in Gaza and in Yemen, and of course in other, this selective empathy, I think, marks, hundreds of years of human history. And I mentioned that in the, I spoke to that in the brief, speech I was able to make. And isn't just something that was happening, from 1940 to 45 in Germany. So all of those things sort of came together in that moment, in that speech.
And James Wilson, you mentioned the commandant and of Auschwitz and his family. What was the challenge in getting the audience to identify with these main characters, with this idyllic family, up against this incomprehensible terror and destruction that was happening that was occurring and that he was presiding over?
Well, I mean, in a way, the challenge that you identify sort of is the core of the film, I think. The questions of the film, I mean, it's not a polemical film. There's not like a message where we're trying to pin it, tie it up with a neat bow. But I think the whole question of the film and the idea, the thinking space of the film, it's a film, I think, that asks you to, it tries to make a space in which you can think, was to lean into some kind of identification with those people, the commandant of Auschwitz and his partner, his wife, to look for the similarities, not the differences. The typical way the Holocaust is narrated is of it's the discourse of what's called Holocaust exceptionalism, right? That the Holocaust stands apart from history, outside of history, as the sort of mythic, almost evil, mystical event. And there's something apolitical and ahistorical in that idea. So the idea of this film was to look for the similarities rather than the differences between us and the perpetrator.
And I wanted to go to a clip from your film when Nazi Commandant Rudolf Haas's wife, Hedwig Hensel, speaks to her mother.
Is that the camp wall?
Yes, that's the camp wall. We planted more vines at the back to grow and cover it.
Maybe Esther Silverman is over there.
Which one was she?
The one I used to clean for.
James Wilson, 10 seconds to wrap.
Well, I mean, just to pick up that last point, it was to look for all those details and aspects of our lives in terms of our aspirations, our desire for household comfort, the things that motivated and drove them.
James Wilson, we're going to leave it there. Congratulations on your Oscar nominations for international film at the Oscars, The Zone of Interest. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3. My name's Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, just a quick reminder before we get into the mix of things today. Everything that's said on this program is not necessarily representative of the views of WRCT or its members, strictly those of myself and the wonderful guest I have on today. Now that that is out of the way, let's roll right into that. Now, today I have a good friend of mine, Zach Berger, fellow libertarian, here to talk a little bit about the Liberty Movement. This is a little thing I've been floating around for a little bit with him, just kind of being like, hey, you know, there is a Liberty Movement, to kind of see where do we go with this? You know, like, there's the ideas, we have these strongly held beliefs. How exactly do these get enacted? But before I get into that, just like to welcome you onto the show, Zach. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Anthony. I really appreciate it.
Yes, I mean, you, like myself, are a libertarian. How did you find yourself in this peculiar position? I mean, you're among the wonderful 2-3% national vote in the presidential election. I mean, you know, it was an interesting sort of journey for me, kind of moving from like 2016, like rah 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 Trump, to kind of throughout COVID a more mellow, like, well, maybe the government shouldn't be doing this, and eventually you know, moving into the libertarian sphere. But tell us a little bit about how you kind of entered that.
So I mean, really, it's a similar experience. Dissatisfaction, I guess, is the best way to express it. I felt dissatisfied with the way current politics of our nation was going. I definitely have that same trajectory of rah 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 in 2016, and then realizing, hey, this isn't going right. I don't like these people. I don't like these parties. There's got to be somewhere that I fit in with, really, that really aligns with how I envision our government should be. And I found the Liberty Movement.
So what was kind of like your gateway Liberty Movement thing?
Well, I mean, let's see. The dysfunction definitely hit something home for me. The absolute dysfunction of our government made me realize, you know, something's wrong. And then I started researching, and then I came into all these great texts and theorists, and I really was like, this is where I belong. Definitely after, like, the second impeachment of Trump, where I was like, our government just doesn't know what it's doing. It needs to take a step back.
Yeah, I mean, like, in a similar way, I think for most people that COVID and the subsequent events of the 2020 election were kind of just a moment where people stood back and were like, what is going on? You know, like, you know, the entire Trump presidency was kind of a what is going on moment for a lot of people. But for a lot of people, it didn't really – I mean, we kind of had an era of good feelings almost through the early Trump presidency where you saw, you know, like high economic growth, low prices, cutting of taxes. And someone who is, you know, like the primers for being a libertarian are already there. You know, you believe in limited government. You believe in a free economy. These are things that, you know, like the Republican Party says that it is the party of. And we'll kind of get a little bit more into this in a little bit. But kind of something that was turned on its head through the Trump presidency was the limited government, free enterprise mindset of the party that kind of saw itself just almost evaporate, which to me, that's concerning that we see some party that's supposed to be the